And over time, that kind of collective of artists was working on climate change, criminal justice reform. And with the election of Trump, then it became about taking back American identity. It all became an American identity project. And we launched right after Trump's election, We the People, that I think became, from the stats I've seen, it became one of the most viral political art projects in history. I think there were 1 million downloads in 48 hours. And from what it looked like, the majority of people printed them in some form, because the day of the Women's March, we found evidence of the imagery at every documented women's march in the world that we could find a story about.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer, and I'm a documentary filmmaker. On this podcast, I interview the world's best storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. My guest today is Aaron Huey. Aaron Huey is a photographer, artist, an all-around maker of stories. As a National Geographic photographer, Aaron has contributed dozens of cover and feature stories to the magazine. His photography details a wide range of stories, from a drug war in Afghanistan to the lives of Sherpas on Everest to antiquity smuggling in West Africa, life on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, and most recently, Aaron detailed the fight to preserve America's national monuments like Bear's Ears. Aaron works at the intersection of art, journalism, and technology, and is constantly pushing the boundary of conventional storytelling practices. On top of his life as a photographer, Aaron is also the founder of Amplifier. He was the design director for their art project, We the People, that flooded the streets of Donald Trump's inauguration and the Women's March of 2017. The project was funded through a Kickstarter that raised $1.36 million in 8 days, breaking a crowdfunding record to become the most backed art Kickstarter in history. If you just type Amplifier Art into Google, you will absolutely recognize these iconic images. In this conversation, Aaron and I discuss how his background as an artist influences his photography, how he is breaking out of the conventional forms of photojournalism to tell more nuanced and powerful stories, and how he stepped across the journalism and activism divide and helped create one of the most viral artistic movements in history. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Aaron Huey. Aaron Huey, thank you so much for joining me from your home office in Seattle. It is great to meet you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure. So you're based in Seattle, but from following your work, it seems like you travel quite a bit. How much of the year would you say you are on the road?
Probably more than 50%.
Is that a part of the job that you really love?
I need it. I don't know if I always love it, but I need it always. And how I travel and where I travel has changed over time. I'm a lot more domestic than I was in my early days of shooting. Mm.
And why do you say you need it?
I don't know if I think that for a lot of makers, I might be stretching this, but for a lot of makers, I don't think we're choosing. I think that making is an impulse that overrides all of the other things in my life. And so whether I want to or not, I'll always be making in some form. And so it's what drives me more than anything that comes out of my mind. If photography is what I'm making at the moment, it's going to be driving me, whether I want it to or not. You know, it overrides family sometimes. It's why I think so many of us have a hard time keeping families together.
And has that been challenging for you?
There is no way for that not to be a conversation in a family where you've got kids and a wife and a family that stays home while you travel. And I think all of my peers would agree to that. So I think it has to be an open and constant and constantly evolving conversation to keep a family together as a maker at this level.
And that impulse as a maker, when did that develop for you growing up?
Oh boy, I always it wasn't photography originally for me. I was always a painter, a printmaker, a sculptor. It manifests in a lot of different ways. I have a compulsion to make, and so I fill my downtime, in quotes, with massive construction projects and art projects and book projects, and so it's always been there from my earliest memories.
Were your parents makers or into the arts and in any way that like kind of pushed you into that realm?
My father was. I didn't grow up with him, but when I would visit my father, much of the time would be funneled into making and like having that freedom to explore that at kind of quite deeply and at high levels. So there was always an encouragement to make at all times. And his life was filled with the arts. He studied the opera and sang opera in San Francisco, and he was in a lot of early American TV sitcom-y kind of things in the 1960s and 70s as a singer and dancer. So a lot more of his work was performative. He shot some photos and did art with his hands. But I remember he always told me a story of how frustrated I would get when I was really, really little, like 3 or 4 years old or 5 years old, that I couldn't make as good of drawings as he did. So he stopped kind of making them around me and kind of slowly stopped doing the art and started supporting me.
Is that because you're competitive?
I think it's just that I was frustrated I couldn't make what he was making. I'm sure I'm probably quite competitive too. But as I say this, I also, it makes me think, when I go on trips with my own son and he has his camera, I shoot a lot less photos.
Hmm.
Not because I'm worried that he will think that he can't make what I can make, but because I just want to be the supporter. And because being around kids and making things requires a different mindset than, and I have, it needs so much more attention. So I found myself doing that throughout the Hawkeye project as well. When we traveled, I was not making photographs very often unless they were of him, because I was so in awe of what he himself was making.
Right. When you were doing those kind of making projects and in all sorts of forms, construction projects and graphic projects, what about that connected to with you? You know, it was probably unconscious at that time, but reflecting on it, why do you think that really resonated with you at that age?
Well, all the construction and all of the art, they're all happening now. They've never stopped. The construction is just later in life because I'm bigger and I can actually make buildings now. But I don't know if I can separate with my mind why I make. I don't know if I can even reflect on that. Like, it is a core instinct and almost almost a compulsion. I can't not make. So
yeah.
I think I have a hard time separating it. It's just an organic part of who I am. And it keeps shifting the kinds of things I make and the mediums that I work in. I'm known to a lot of people as a photographer, but it's just one vehicle for me. And I aspire to be, you know, in my old age, if I look at the arc of my old age, who I really want to be like is Leonard Knight. Leonard Knight wasn't a photographer. He was a guy everybody thought was crazy that made a man-made mountain and spent 27 years piling up Adobe and house paint until he made a man-made mountain. Like, that's what I want to be when I get old.
So when did photography come into your life? When did you start taking photos?
Photography came into my life not until partway through college. I was studying painting and sculpture and printmaking, and photography became a portable way to make for me. I was really just a backpacker, but I took a camera and found myself starting to make stories. But I didn't come from a journalism background. I came from painting and printmaking and visualizing in that way.
Hmm. So as someone myself who comes from a journalism background, I'm sure you work with a lot of people who do come from a more traditional journalism background. What do you think your art background that you brought to photography what kind of skill set does that lend itself to that maybe people coming from journalism have a little bit less of?
I think it gives me less allegiance to the formality of it all. I am kind of at this moment almost more interested in changing the shape of the container and the distribution methods than I am in an allegiance to like the formal aspects of honing the photojournalistic craft. And so that's probably why I ended up making things like the art projects with Shepard Fairey or weird book projects that I know not very many people will want, or photogrammetry projects that can work in AR and VR, or, you know, community storytelling projects through social media. It's all, I'm almost more interested in all of these like side methodologies in distribution and experimentation than the main channel itself. Mm,
gotcha. When you were getting started with photography, and you were starting to learn how to make good photos and things like that, what were some of the, either a person or something that was influential to you in thinking about how to make good photos?
Oh, in the beginning, it was pretty old school. I was just like, you know, I was in love with the work of the Magnum photographers and David Allen Harvey. And I, you know, the only photo job I ever had was like being Steve McCurry's coffee boy in New York City. and that was a really valuable experience. And not because he was there, because he was mostly on the road, but I had access to every photograph he had ever shot in analog form in a, as like the cabinets and cabinets and cabinets of slides. And I went through every slide cabinet and looked at every single slide, I think maybe almost that he had ever taken in his life, one by one.
Wow.
Sheet by sheet. So, I mean, a lot of my early learning was definitely through like the formal masters of, you know, like Magnum style photography, traditional photojournalism. And, I think I'm probably, you know, my understanding of painting and printmaking and form and color and studying all of that must subconsciously build now what is how I see and make.
That's very cool. And let me kind of try to take it a layer deeper on that as someone who doesn't have a background in painting or art outside of using the camera. What are some things that influence your photo making, whether you just kind of mentioned like color, something like that? Like, can you be, take a specific into one of those things?
It's interesting. I don't think about the formality of my photography very often, of what makes it what it is. And it changes so much assignment to assignment. You know, if I'm with people, then I'm driven by finding intimacy and access, right? And, you know, I think the deeper and more intimate you get, the more visual layers and emotion that happen in the imagery. But then I get surprised by these kind of weird assignments I've gotten lately that are in the landscape, and that's not from my original background. And I have to kind of relearn how to be a photographer because I'm not a landscape photographer and I'm not a wildlife photographer. So I'm like relearning on the fly.
So when you get an assignment to do something like that, what's the process of retraining yourself and retraining that eye?
Oh, well, on my last one, on this last cover story I had on the National Monuments and Public Lands in Danger, it was pretty intimidating because I went out into the landscape and I knew there weren't going to be many people I could access. And it was pretty scary because I thought this is going to be a very flat story. I am not a great photographer of some of these kinds of things. And so that story really required me to come up with an evolution in storytelling so that it didn't end up just being a flat catalog of, you know, Patagonia catalog images of landscapes and ruins. So that's why I brought in the aspect of photogrammetry, you know, mapping the surface of different sites with a camera and then making massive VR models that could also be turned into AR models to build experiences around, because I needed a kind of depth that I didn't really know how to make in the landscape using the traditional tools.
And so for the listeners out there who don't know what
photogrammetry
from photogrammetry is, can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so I had seen kind of smaller models of rock art and different things that were models that you could turn around and examine, and, you know, in a virtual space or on a computer screen, that were millimeter accurate. You could tilt them and zoom in and look at microscopic details of these objects almost. And I got excited about the idea of doing that with massive ancestral Puebloan structures. You know, on this assignment was in Bears Ears National Monument, and there are structures that are, you know, 1,000, 2,000 years old sometimes, rock art that's thousands of years older than that. And I thought it would be a really interesting way to bring dimension to the story, and pairing the voices of indigenous elders and archaeologists with those could really bring them to life in a way that the magazine story couldn't. So I would shoot thousands and thousands of photographs of a structure and put it into a really complex algorithm, and it would build these huge virtual objects. I did all this with my partner Devlin Gandhi, and we built a series of experiences about those structures, and they came out with the National Geographic story.
So cool. So National Geographic gives you an assignment to go to Bears Ears, and then you pitch them this idea. I mean, where does that idea come from?
The secondary part that I just talked about?
Yeah.
Yeah, that they didn't know I was going to do that. I did that on my own with my own money, and then I talked them into it later.
Oh, okay.
While I was in the middle of the assignment. Because from an editor's perspective, you know, there's the core assignment is the priority. Filling the pages, you know, there are buckets of money for that, and it's the priority. It's what created the assignment. It's why I'm there. And they're, you know, probably quite worried about a distraction from that. But I saw in this story that if we didn't do that, it was going to be quite forgettable, just because I didn't think it had enough dimensions. So I would always add on extra days and go out with my own time and money and find ways to keep making in this other way. And then I eventually got a grant from the National Geographic Society to pay myself back and to continue working on the project.
Very cool. So I saw your talk at the National Geographic Storytellers Summit. And for the listeners out there, everyone in the audience got to put on a VR headset and go into these landscapes that Aaron was photographing and experience them in VR. And as they're doing so, there is a narration from the indigenous people who call that place home. And that led me to wonder, over your career, how has including the people who you are photographing in the storytelling process, has that always been a part of your photography, or how has that changed over time as a photographer for you?
Well, I think in complex stories, like any story about a whole community or any story about a community that you're not part of, especially coming in as, like, you know, as a white person coming into a place that has a deep indigenous, you know, where the whole story is the story of an indigenous people, even if they haven't lived in that place for the last 1,000 years, not including those voices would be crazy, because I don't have the knowledge to be able to fill that story up. So the more of those voices that are included, the more layers of the story appear and the more true it becomes. You can tell a really beautiful story from one perspective, and that's what a lot of photography is. It's just through my lens and my life's experience and how I see frames, and I push the button and I can make really beautiful pictures. But I think that truth can be quite shallow if that's all that's presented when you're telling the story of a whole community. So I first started trying to add layers when I did my my Pine Ridge story in 2011, 2012, I knew going into that everybody was going to consider it a massive failure no matter how I did with the photography, because people would say to me as I was working on the story, well, you have to have this or the story won't work. You have to have a story of the, you know, a buffalo hunt. You have to have a story of a valedictorian. You have to have the story of this part of the ceremony. You have to have the story about the kid that made it out and was a big success, you know, in Nebraska. And and that people would give me these lists of everything I had to have or the story would fail. And I thought, oh, well, this is like, you guys, it would be great if you guys could tell this story yourselves. So,
The people saying that were the people who lived there.
Yeah. And one, we don't have enough, there's not enough space in a traditional editorial to include more than like two or three perspectives, really, or you start to get lost. That's just what an editorial piece is. And when you're telling the story of an entire people, that's like an auto fail, really, if you're trying to get depth into. You know, you can get kind of poetry in that of a couple perspectives, but the people want to be heard, and there are so many amazing stories that get left on the cutting room floor. So I spent much of that year building a project with Jonathan Harris while I was at Stanford so that anybody from Pine Ridge could stream their own stories unedited into National Geographic, and it would co-launch with the cover story. So it was my outsider perspective with like the high aesthetic merged at the moment of publication with hundreds and hundreds of stories with no editing, you know, stories with where people were singing or telling poetry or telling jokes and putting up their written pieces and telling their stories about their valedictorian son and the buffalo hunt and every story they wanted to tell. And that in my mind is the perfect storytelling, where the professional story from the outside merges with the community story from the inside, and they're co-published. That as a model is hard to execute because it's unbelievably time consuming and requires a platform that most people aren't using. And it's just each one would have to be such a special case and executed by a whole team. But it's still, to me, the perfect story is that merged story.
Yeah. Has that become easier at all now that just everyone has a camera and everyone is kind of telling stories on social media about their personal lives every day?
You can. I mean, now you could, like, you know, if we had been using Instagram really heavily in 2011, which we weren't, we probably could have done something a little bit similar by just creating a hashtag that said My Pine Ridge Story.
Right.
Right. And curating that somehow. So I still think that, like, packaging it, you know, together in a way that it can be presented outside of the control of something like an Instagram can still be helpful, because you can give it a different kind of context and feeling. And so with the story I just did on Bear's Ears and the VR we're talking about, we didn't have, you know, an opportunity to tell thousands of stories, but we could take my technical capabilities and storytelling knowledge of how to make that container of the VR and the object and what it looked like, and then the indigenous voices could tell the whole story themselves. So that was another kind of, in my mind, a perfect merging. I was really the technician, but they led all storytelling.
Gotcha. So when you get assignments these days, you know, kind of what I'm hearing from you is that really the story is dictating the form, and you are in no way tied to the traditional sense of a photographer, that your form is constantly being shaped by what the story needs. So when you get assignments, do you have a process, or how do you come up with these ideas for the shape of the story?
Yeah, I'm definitely making it up as I go. That last story I was talking about was a public land story that started very traditionally, and then I saw that it needed to, like, take a radical departure to build something alongside of it. The next thing I'm going to work on that's not finalized yet may begin with the majority of its budget in VR and AR.
Okay.
But then maybe I'll build photographic stories around the VR and AR, depending on what happens when I arrive, what the story needs. If I'm in a place to scan a bunch of cultural heritage sites, but all around it is incredible culture and storytelling and, you know, audio and music and elders telling stories, then I have to evolve that to figure out what the best medium is to capture that, what the best way is to broadcast that collection of knowledge. So it's now at this point, it's so case by case, I couldn't even really guess.
Okay. Yeah. What do you think separates a National Geographic photographer from the average person taking photos on their cell phone?
Oh, well, we're under a lot more pressure. We have to, you know, we've got to fill all the pages of that magazine with National Geographic quality imagery, and those images are incredibly hard to get to find, to make, to see. So few of the days that we're out, like, breaking our back and risking our lives end up, you don't see photos from most of those days. So, you know, one photo for every 10 days of suffering, maybe, you know, is what you end up seeing. So that's one thing that immediately separates somebody with their camera, is they're probably not putting in 10 days of suffering and risking their life to try and get a frame for Instagram.
Yeah.
And I think also we're, you know, we are thinking the entire time about the architecture of the story. I think anybody can make one good picture. And that's one of the, like, everybody is a photographer. Everybody can stumble into a lucky photograph or good light and make an amazing photo with their iPhone and get tons of likes on Instagram. But there are very few people, I think, that understand how to craft a great story and how to do storytelling, especially the way that National Geographic does storytelling. You know, it's some of it's like really basic elements, like the visual diversity of imagery that creates an arc that carries you through a narrative. Like, how do you flow through that? Like, what's the river of visuals that draws you in and carries you along that path so that you learn something through that process from the first picture to the last in a story. So that, I think that's very hard to do. I don't think a lot of people do that really very well. And to credit our editors, that's also such a huge part of the process. Like, we work with the best editors in the world and we sit down with them in person and we go frame by frame almost through every single frame that we've shot over the course of a year and a half of work, to think about and talk about and workshop what that visual arc looks like.
So I'd love to transition to one of the other projects that you're involved in and how I got connected with you, which is your work with Amplifier.
Mm-hmm.
And Amplifier to me seems like a beautiful blend of kind of what we've been talking about in your background of your art background with photography, how the form is really in service of the story that needs to be told. And I'd love to hear the genesis of this idea and how Amplifier became such an incredible part of a global movement.
Well, I'll try and keep this short. The Amplifier story is a hard one to shorten. It has a lot of lives. That project actually started while I was working on the cover story for National Geographic, or a little bit before that, when I was making imagery on the reservation, and I realized that no magazine could ultimately do what I wanted to do because the people wanted advocacy out in the world, and that's not what magazines are for. Magazines are for not for picking sides, usually. And I wanted to pick a side. And in my TED talk, I picked a side. And, when I talked about treaty rights, and then I, you know, my TED wish was that the treaties would be honored. And I knew at the end of that talk was kind of my introduction to activism. I kind of stepped off the cliff there using editorial style imagery to make an activist ask. So there wasn't a publication that could help with that. And I had this dream, like, what if I could get like the greatest street artist in the world to help me take those images and make them into something that could bypass magazines and bypass traditional routers for publication and could go straight to the streets where people couldn't choose to subscribe or not subscribe. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think I could get to Shepard, but in the meanwhile, someone had connected me to his understudy. I didn't know it was his understudy at the time, Ernesto Llerena. And I asked Ernesto and he said yes right away and started working on the first Honor the Treaties imagery using photographs I had taken on at Pine Ridge. And then almost immediately after that, he said, I think we should get Shepard. And I know him. And he introduced me and the project started like almost immediately. Shepard said yes immediately. And we made a body of work around treaty rights, really as like a media experiment to say, how can we reach new audiences by merging this art and this imagery? And we made tens and tens of thousands of wheat paste, and they went up all over the country. And over time, that evolved, and I moved away from being the person making the imagery and started giving the money to other people to make the art with any imagery they chose, or to work with the photographers they wanted to work with, or sometimes we would pair artists with photographers. And over time, that kind of collective of artists was working on climate change, criminal justice reform. And with the election of Trump, then it became about taking back American identity. It all became an American identity project. And we launched right after Trump's election, We the People, that I think became, from the stats I've seen, it became one of the most viral political art projects in history.
Wow.
Just because of how the internet is now. So if the Hope poster had happened in 2016, it would possibly have spread more, but just because so many more of us are using the internet to move things and so much more of the world is connected, these We the People images that Shepard Fairey made and that Ernesto made and that Jessica Sabogal made, that group of artists, I think there were 1 million downloads in 48 hours. And from what it looked like, the majority of people printed them in some form because the day of the Women's March, we found evidence of the imagery at every documented Women's March in the world that we could find a story about.
Wow.
And we took out the same imagery that was, you know, based on photos and reinterpreted by artists. We took out full-page ads in the Washington Post, USA Today, and the New York Times, and that was millions of analog print ads flooding the streets that we asked people to take into the streets. And then we in person handed out another 50,000 just in Washington, D.C. out of the back of vans of big placards. So
what is the difference between having a campaign that has like one of your photos and people are hoisting that in the air with a slogan versus having the artistic rendition of that?
For the quick glance in the streets, an illustration is more powerful than any photograph. It's just like the propaganda art of, you know, Russia, China, and the Koreas. You know, they made that work in that style for a reason. Shepard Fairey makes his work in that style for a reason. It stops you in the streets. You can read it and understand it from a long ways away. It doesn't take a lot of time to interpret. You have to be able to walk by and understand it in a fraction of a second. You know, not just the simpleness, the simple nature of like having an iconic image that you can read, but the words too. You have to have words that can translate in a fraction of a second. So one word, two words, three words, maybe four or five, but you know, very few words, very simple images.
Mm-hmm. So for the images that were most prevalent during the Women's March, I think all the listeners out there would probably recognize those images immediately if they were to see them, and we'll have links to those in the show notes. But what was the process for determining the people who would be illustrated and the text or the message that would go along to mm-hmm. help tell that story of reclaiming that identity?
Yeah, we didn't choose the specific people for the images. First, we chose which communities we wanted to address, and so we had, we picked an artist in New York, and we picked an artist in San Antonio, Texas, and we picked an artist that had originally come from Syria to represent Black, Hispanic, and Muslim communities that were under attack at the time. Ernesto did an indigenous woman in his image, and then Jessica did a gay couple. But we assigned photographers to go out and make new bodies of work, and sometimes that worked and sometimes it didn't. Some of the photographers came back with images that we didn't think were as strong as something in their existing portfolio. And so after having done a whole assignment, we ended up taking all of those images and their original portfolios and then sometimes chose something they had already made just to find the most iconic image.
Okay.
So before we even knew what the words would be or what anything would look like, we just started sending photographers out to go into communities under attack and to start making pictures of the people that we thought represented our country right now. You know, the project was called We the People. And while those photographers were making images, we had a series of convenings in New York and in California where we brought together groups of people, journalists, artists, poets, representatives from the UN, all kinds of people, people from the D School at Stanford, just a lot of different kinds of minds to answer the question, what do you say when the whole world is watching? We knew that we wanted to work on American identity, but what do you say when you've got, you know, the entire world looking at a million pieces of art? What are the words supposed to be on those pieces of art? So over the course of those days, it was chiseled down into We the People, just reclaiming simple language. And then we gave the artists, we gave Shepard the images we hoped he would work with and the language, and then the artists did their work. Ernesto chose his own, and because he's just such a brilliant artist in making this work in the activist space. It was a crazy ride. It was 2 months of like 18 and 20 hour days, it felt like, from you know, a week after or 5 days after the election to the inauguration, every day.
Did you anticipate? I mean, I guess it would be hard to anticipate just how viral it went. But what were your expectations when you were creating this?
We knew that it could be big just because it was like a second moment of hope, you know, like the hope image in a time with no hope. And we knew we had the tools and we knew how to use the tools. I felt like I had a good understanding of how to tell a story in a crowdfunding platform. We were using Kickstarter. I had already done just the year, but 2 years before I did a crowdfunding campaign that raised $500,000 in 1 week for Sherpa families.
Wow.
After the avalanche there. And it was just a flash sale of $100 Nat Geo prints. It was the first ever Nat Geo flash sale and the first time Nat Geo photographers ever really offered images that way. So I think I had an understanding of how to use the tools, and I could see the wave of fear and desperation and people and hope of people wanting something to hold on to. And I thought we had something they could hold on to that said what people wanted said. So we had a lot of confidence. We had a lot of confidence. I don't know if we had $1.4 million in confidence, because we raised almost $1.4 million in 7.5 days.
Wow.
To make and execute and distribute all of that art.
And that was the distribution that went to, you know, placing ads in the Washington Post,
yeah,
and printing these huge ones and putting, yeah, everywhere. Wow. That's incredible. So what is the state nowadays of Amplifier, and how are you involved, and what are the goals of Amplifier as an organization now of using art for positive change?
We are right now focused almost exclusively on the census and get out the vote efforts for 2020.
Okay.
I think we will also be doing some work to transcend borders, to look at climate change from a youth perspective. So we're also looking at moving into some animated video. But we're going to spend a lot of this year doing on-the-ground listening tours, meeting with communities, meeting new artists, testing and prototyping visuals and language, and just learning so that, you know, by the end of the year and early next year, we'll know what we're supposed to be putting out. We have a lot to learn. Our expertise is not in any of the subjects we're making art about. It's in the visual execution.
Mm-hmm. And
so I'm not actually in any part of the image making at this point. I'm creative director, you know, creative lead, where I'm trying to come up more of the concepts of distribution strategy. I'll still like have oversight on how we think about what kinds of images we want out there and language crafting. But I've really stepped back. We're going to hire artists and photographers and give, you know, empower them to make a lot more of those decisions, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah. Hire a lot more artists so that we can really just be constantly prototyping so that the, you know, organically the right thing will arise, I think.
Yeah.
Over this year.
In terms of the distribution, what do you think that the style of, like, you know, pasting this to the backs of signs and bringing it kind of to the streets instead of you saying, we're going to pitch this story idea to like a traditional media outlet and maybe they'll run it about like identity, like that distribution method, what does that lend itself to the greater story of this movement?
Well, yeah, we're definitely not going to count on any traditional editorial outlets. If we make something really amazing in the world, then editorial outlets will cover them. But I think this is a moment where we have to, it's almost like we need to find a new media. I want to figure out how to project mile-wide projections on the bottom of clouds. Like I want to super next level this thing. Like, we need a whole new unregulated media. Now, I'm not going to be satisfied until we find that. But for a lack of that, I think we just have to keep pushing into new distribution wherever we can find it. Sometimes that might just be going back to really simple stuff like the newspaper, but testing particular markets in like small town newspapers where everybody still does read the newspaper, or taking over the Goodyear blimp, or, you know, going into classrooms and finding ways to work with teachers. You know, we this year got into 20,000 classrooms with a project called We the Future. So over 300,000 students are likely seeing the work that we're making every day in a classroom. And each piece of art comes with concrete paths for action so that kids asking questions can have a whole path to follow if they want to do something about that, whether it's climate change or gun control or, you know, any kind of equal rights issue. They can actually, when they ask the question, the teacher can give them a whole packet on how to become involved in some form or learn more.
Hmm. Was it scary at all for you to kind of cross that boundary between journalism and activism? And nowadays, what do you consider yourself?
I was a little bit nervous about it in the beginning, especially like I thought initially when I did that TED talk. I mean, I got my Nat Geo assignment to do the cover story on Pine Ridge right after my TED talk. So they had seen the TED talk. So they clearly knew my opinion on that matter. But when I started doing all the street art stuff, I was quite hesitant at first to share it with anybody around the Nat Geo community, because I was afraid people would think I was biased. But I think we all are. I mean, everybody's a little bit biased. Everybody gets into a story and they find something they're quite passionate about, and we just have to sort it differently when we're doing like the editorial structure. But I think Nat Geo has also embraced passionate storytelling in that form. Like, they gave me a platform to be able to talk about all the other ways I used media instead of shying away from it and saying, well, that's activism. He shouldn't have feelings about the American genocide. They said, yeah. Oh, this is kind of amazing. This is a great way to expose more of that story of our past. And this new medium is worthy of sharing. And so I think they really embraced that new media and new way of thinking about it and feeling it. Like, it, we want to see how our photographers feel their stories. And that's the story within the story sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mentioned, at the beginning of the interview that I checked out your storytelling summit talk at National Geographic. And one of the things you said in that talk that struck me was you talked about the job description of any National Geographic storyteller is to witness, illuminate, and inspire action. And one of the things that I really admire about the work you do, is how focused you are on inspiring action. And it's something that I always want to let that dictate the stories I tell. I want to let that propel me to work harder. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, what makes the difference between a storyteller who is able to witness and illuminate, and that's just about it, versus one who really can inspire action? Because the stories that you have been a part of really have.
Well, I think that's where, like, you can get stuck in the formality maybe of photography, where you can witness and then illuminate it through like the beauty of framing and color and light. But maybe it's like, for me, that I do often kind of pick a side and try to do something about some piece of the story. You know, whether it's like, you know, after the Sherpas died at Everest, a fundraiser, or realizing that, you know, on Pine Ridge, people weren't being heard and that white people were telling all their stories and they needed to tell their own, and getting all those extra voices in, or making the Bear's Ears story, you know, the most prominent part be, you know, an indigenous voice led experience. All of those, even if, like, in the Bear's Ears one, I'm not saying, hey, go do something. I think that by adding those extra elements, that heart, like the human voice and that experience, that it inherently inspires people to want to protect public lands and be more active in that conversation. I don't know. I think I'd rambled there, but I think it's really just, I think you can get lost potentially in the formality of just a pretty picture. And I think we should all be trying to make more than just pretty pictures, because anybody can do that.
Beautiful. Yeah. All right. So, to the listeners, Aaron's going to stick around for a few more minutes for our post show, which you can listen to by going to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms for just $2 a month. You can get access to the post shows with my guests like Aaron, and we'll go a little bit deeper into the craft of storytelling. But before we end this portion of the main show, Aaron, if people want to follow your work, where should we send them?
Well, I haven't updated my website in 4 years. So probably if you want to know what I'm working on, probably Argonaut Photo. It's my handle at Instagram. Or just look up Aaron Huey on Instagram. Okay. And Amplifier is pretty easy to follow in all of those projects. That's just amplifier.org.
Cool. And if there's anyone out there who is capable of projecting onto the bottoms of clouds, I know Aaron would really appreciate hearing from you.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Aaron, so much for joining the Austin Meyer podcast.
You bet, man.
That's it for episode 18 of the Austin Meyer podcast. Thank you so much to Aaron Huey for taking the time to share his knowledge. the way he thinks about storytelling and the form in which his stories take shape is really inspiring to me, and it has me reflecting on many of the conventions that I take for granted, how I can really do a better job letting the stories dictate the form and not always taking the form for granted. And the thing I'm also thinking about is I think there's so much value in developing a deep understanding of the traditional methods of storytelling. For me as a documentary filmmaker, understanding the conventions and the traditional methods of doing a documentary film, mastering those, and then with that foundational understanding, breaking out of the box to tell even more impactful stories. As I mentioned, if you want to hear the post-show with Aaron and all our future guests, head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. For just $2 a month, you'll get access to a private podcast feed, which will play in your native podcast app. Post shows and additional episodes are all going to be coming out there, and your support goes directly to helping fund the production of the podcast. So thank you. I really appreciate that. And in this week's post show, Aaron talks about his favorite piece of storytelling gear and about his 8-year-old son, who is National Geographic's youngest photographer. A very talented family. So here's a little teaser of this week's post show.
My son is the youngest National Geographic photographer. He and I started shooting stuff together for National Geographic when he was 4.5 years old. And when we just were out last week in Joshua Tree National Park, and I like doing Instagram stories, you know, of those journeys of him making photographs and of us being together, because they can be.
So again, to check that out, head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. A big thank you to Opus Orange, who composed our theme music for today. And lastly, a couple shout-outs to Free Solo and Period End of Sentence, the two documentaries that took home Oscars this past week. So well-deserved. Such beautiful and honest films. And those are giving me a lot of inspiration this week, adding a lot of value to my life. And highly recommend checking those out if you hadn't had a chance yet. That's it from me. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen. I really appreciate it. I'm so grateful. And I will see you next time on the Austin Meyer Podcast. And until then, go out and tell some stories.